Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and today we're going to drink.
We are. How about that? It's actually a good thing to think about on days when you look out the window from the studio and the leaves are falling everywhere.
Yeah.
It's time to think about vintage.
Oh, vintage.
There you go. Vintage.
Right. Well, I enjoyed this first interview. This gives you a clue. I really enjoyed this interview with Eric Asimov.
Right. And did we actually say the whole program is about wine?
No.
I don't think we did.
We said drinking.
Drinking. Well, in fact, it's about wine and about some very interesting opinions on the subject of wine generally and what to do in an era when we're all thinking about our pocketbooks and therefore thinking about how we can shop more economically for wine. Two excellent viewpoints about that. But we've had a couple of recent programs. One, an interview with Terry Teese, who wrote a wonderful book called Between the Vines. And another excellent program not too long ago. I can't remember the name of the person we interviewed, but he opened a wine shop in what used to be the Fulton Fish Market.
Uncorked.
Uncorked, there you go. And Eric Asimov, our guest in this first segment, knew both of those books very well. And I have to say that between the three of them, three excellent, quite learned, but very, very interesting books, all about the subject of wine. And first off, leading off today's program, then Eric Asimov with a memoir and a manifesto. It's always interesting to find someone who's not only directly famous, but peripherally famous as well.
I feel far more peripherally famous than directly.
No.
I get a lot more Isaac questions.
Well, that's what I was about to say. It's not every day that you get to interview the nephew of probably one of the most famous science fiction writers of all time, Isaac Asimov, and the son of Stanley Asimov, who himself was a journalist of no mean nature with, I believe, Newsday.
This is genetic, isn't it?
Well, it's really funny because Eric in his book doesn't say that. In fact, he almost says the opposite. But let's first of all quickly make sure that listeners know that we're actually speaking with Eric Asimov.
And the title of the book is How to Love Wine, which is really an intriguing title, subtitled A Memoir and Manifesto, which adds to the intrigue, Eric.
And we're going to dispel the mystery behind both of those things as we talk about one of the better wine books that's ever been written and one of the better wine books I've read almost all the way through. How about that, Eric?
That's very flattering. I appreciate that.
Well, I wanted to know what the story was because you get started and it's obvious you're going to overturn some shibboleths. There's a $10 word for you if you like. there are some
one of my favorite words.
Yeah, I like it too.
Yeah, okay. There are some sacred cows you're going to slay. There are a wide variety of things you're going to take on about the business, which is your daily bread, which seems like kind of a really pretty bold thing to do.
Well, the book came about as the wine columnist at the Times. People come up to me and talk to me all the time about wine. And the one consistent message that I get is that people are intimidated by wine. And that's nothing new. The industry knows that. But there's a poignant element to it. People say to me, I want to like wine, but I just don't know anything about it. I don't get the aromas and flavors. I don't really think I'm equipped to like wine.
It's really very sad, isn't it? Because the end result, and you point this out, is that what happens is people who feel intimidated tend to spend more on wine than they really need to have a good experience because that way they feel safer.
That's true. And enough people started that I felt as if I had to figure out why it was so. And I started thinking about the way we talk about wine so often in the language of tasting notes, esoteric and obscure flavors and aromas, the way we think about wine so often in terms of points on the 100-point scale, the way we educate wine and that horrible phrase, wine appreciation, as if it's some sort of another set of manners that you need to learn to be properly civilized. And it occurred to me that when you put together our whole American wine culture, you're conveying to people that before you can simply enjoy wine, you have to know everything about it. You have to, in effect, become a connoisseur. To me, that is completely backward. It counters the way I learned about wine, and different from any other subject, where if you are motivated to probe a subject, to dive deeply into it, it's generally because you've fallen in love with it. You've established an emotional connection that compels you to want to learn more.
Well, this is where the memoir part comes in, I guess.
Yeah, I started to write pretty much of a manifesto, but it kept coming up with personal examples. And the last thing I want to do is hold myself up as the model for how people should go about getting into wine. But I think I am one example of somebody who had a very sort of organic introduction to wine. You read so often, certainly with British wine writers who were in the wine society in their universities and were introduced to all these old great bottles, or other people who were their epiphany when somebody gave them a great bottle. That was never my experience. I was a student and then a graduate student drinking cheap wine on the table, dinner every night.
This is where the memoir part comes in, because without realizing you were doing this, and I think you probably initially didn't even intend to reveal as much of yourself as you did, but as a result of your honesty about the way you learned about wine, you set an example that it's possible for anybody to follow. Because absolutely anybody can do what you did, and it will cost them a whole lot less, and they'll derive a whole lot more enjoyment and satisfaction. They'll be better accepted by their friends. They'll make a whole lot of new friends. All of this because that's your experience, and you can go about it exactly the same way.
Yeah, one of the major wine cliches is that you have to pull cork. You have to drink wine to learn about it. And yet, I believe that is essential. It's absolutely true. And yet, we don't tell people that. We send them to wine classes where they learn how to taste wine and to identify different kinds of wine as if that's at all a useful skill. Why not just look at the label? What's the point? That's more of a game for a professional.
Then you know, we belong to clubs, and it is rather astonishing how much somebody can tell you at a blind tasting has tasted a whole lot of wine. I mean, I could never do it. I had not kind of memory.
But you get what happens is you're setting yourself up for embarrassment. What Eric is saying that it's really kind of silly, because you always will know what the label looks like
when it's something that you buy.
This is something for sommeliers to amuse themselves with after hours. But it gets at another part of our wine culture, and that is the idea that the role of the wine critic is to be absolutely right all the time. And we've created these myths: the man who insures his nose for $1 million, the man who has never forgotten a wine that he's had all through his entire life, who can identify any wine blind. I mean, they're such silly preoccupations and pointless for the purpose of, in my idea, the wine critic is to help people achieve a deeper understanding of what they're drinking and why it might be culturally meaningful, how they can enhance their experience. It has nothing to do with being right all the time, and I think that conveys the wrong message, because most people set themselves against that standard and find themselves wanting.
There are three things, three shibboleths, I guess, to use that $10 word again, that you attack very successfully, and I'd like you to comment on each one of those, and then there are probably some more points that you'd like to emphasize, but here are the three that I got in spades. One was wine speak, the tyranny of tasting notes, as you call it, and
yeah.
the really totally ridiculous vocabulary that people use, supposed experts use, to describe wines, and as though they're going to be helpful to someone as they choose to
dirty socks.
Whether or not they want, oh no, worse things than that, really, really stupid things, and Eric will give us some fine examples. The second one is almost a derivative of that, because he points out at great length and perfectly precisely correct that all these people who are writing these tasting notes only have a momentary association with each one of the wines that they sip, so that it's almost impossible that they could see all these things, taste all these things, sense all these things, and not be able to have them blown away by the next one of the 100 wines they're going to taste today. And then the third is the tyranny of numbers, numerical score. So begin where you like. These are all kind of related subjects, but I think it's important that people have your manifesto, if you like, on this subject.
Well, I think the tasting note language is the worst thing, because, first of all, it suggests that the more different flavors and aromas you can find in a glass is somehow meaningful, and it really isn't. I think it's self-indulgent and kind of an ego gratification game. How creative can I be? How obscure can I be? But what help is it to anybody to know that you found a fig compote or Maduro tobacco or the combination of both in melted licorice, not licorice Twizzler. It's a silly kind of thing. It doesn't begin to convey the character of a wine, and it's only because this language has been perceived to be the way one thinks and talks about wine that the public trucks with it at all. Nobody can really tell the difference between descriptions of wine. One critic will describe it as raspberry, the next critic describes it as boysenberry, the third one describes it as cherry, and the fourth one describes it as cloudberry. If you're a critic and you're describing 100 wines, you're almost compelled, because you're bored to death, that you have to differentiate themselves among them somehow. But I think that the more generally we can talk about the character of a wine, the more insight the consumer will have. Very, very sort of incremental nuances between similar wines are generally irrelevant.
I have this feeling, Eric, that at some point you're going to turn a street corner in New York and James Mulvers is going to mug you.
Well, I'm sure he'll try on Twitter, but I have a lot of respect for James, and it's unfortunate that I use him as an example, but he's a good guy and a good reporter.
Well, back to the second thing I observed, maybe, I think it was, the limited amount of time that the supposed wine experts have to be able to encounter a wine.
Yes.
And
well, that's another thing. If you are tasting 100 wines before lunch, you're giving a very short shrift to each of them, a taste, sip, a spit, swirl, move on to the next one. And it's my contention that with good wines, and note that this is an important distinction between good wines, honest wines, authentic wines, and the sort of mass-produced commodity wines that are really not worth much time anyway. But with good wines, you cannot hope to assess them in that way. Good wines are alive, and they change in the glass. They change according to the context in which they're consumed, time of day, company, mood, weather, food. There are all kinds of variables that go into assessing a wine. And sure, if you want to focus on quality, you want to remove some of those variables. But it's misleading to believe that you can nail a wine down in such a quick session and sort of create this ironclad profile of it, because the next day when you taste it, it's going to be different if it's a good wine. And that doesn't even begin to talk about, because wine is so affected by context, all the wines that you taste before and after are going to change your perception of it. So there's a reason why professionals do that, and it's because if you're a wine buyer for a store or a restaurant, you many choices that you have to make that you can't help but do it that way. But you cannot tell me that the public ought to assess wines that way, go to tastings and try to figure out what they like, or really be swayed by critics who are doing such mass tastings.
Then you go to the third level, perhaps the worst thing of all.
I'm not sure that's the worst thing of all. I find most disturbed by the tasting notes, and in fact, I'm very sympathetic to the consumer embrace of the 100-point scale.
It is something to refer to. This is true.
When you go into a wine shop and you don't know a lot about wines, it's intimidating. There's no two ways about that. Most wines cost money, especially good wines, and you don't want to waste it, and you want some help in making your buying decision. And that's why the rating scale is so effective. But again, I believe it's misleading in the way that we try to talk about demystifying wine or teaching people 10 things they need to know so they never make a wine mistake. And that's what it really is. It's sort of a defensive posture that one adopts to try to ensure against making a mistake. But to put all wines on this sort of rigid universal scale is again misleading. It completely ignores context, and it completely privileges the historic wine regions that are sort of in some cases, the residue of a 19th century worldview of wine. Our world has changed so much, and there's such a wonderful diversity of wines today. And when you see wines rated against each other, and you know that the Napa wines or the Bordeaux's are always going to get 95s, but the wines from Sicily are going to be capped at a lower place, or Beaujolais, when those wines, in fact, if you're going to have a certain kind of dinner at home, those might be by far the better choices than Bordeaux or a Cabernet. So the scale, again, sends misleading messages to people, and when wine doesn't act as they expect it to, I think they doubt themselves, because, after all, critics are always right.
Now, you do say something, and this is what other people who we respect have written on the subject of buying wine, and that is, try to find a good local wine merchant that you can get to know, so that you have the opportunity to share what your preferences are, and he or she is going to know what it is they have that might satisfy their preferences. So here's a piece of constructive advice that gets you away from the numbers, and not only gets you away from the numbers, but actually allows you to buy a bottle of wine that you can buy now because there is some in the store.
I absolutely believe that, and it's one of the unfortunate facts about wine is that no matter how we try to simplify it or make it easier to understand or safer to buy, all of these efforts cannot disguise that wine is, in fact, a very complex phenomenon. It's like you wouldn't try to be an expert in golf by watching a video and thinking you can go out there. It takes a long time of practice and dedication. And so it's similar in wine. But a good wine shop with clerks who are passionate about what they do is just one of the best resources you can have, especially if you kind of engage with them and get them to invest themselves in your enjoyment of the wine. And if you are willing to put in some time, it's actually a great way to learn about wine with the assistance of a wine shop, which I outline in the book. I think that's a sort of an old-fashioned notion, like the snobby sommelier who's going to sneer at you and rip you off, and the wine shops who are going to rip you off. Of course, there's always going to be unscrupulous people, but a good wine shop where people are just desperate for something is a wonderful thing.
I want to ask you one more question before we go, because I know you have another appointment on our heels. I want you to put on now your most powerful wine critic in the world hat. On top of it is your Robert Parker hat, and on top of it is your Hugh Johnson Jancis Robinson hat. And now name three wines that you think are today the most underappreciated, that if people haven't tried, they should.
Oh, my.
You thought this was going to be easy.
Underappreciated wines. Well, I can't say whether they're underappreciated or not, but I think these are wines that are maybe undervalued. Maybe that's the same thing.
Okay.
But I would start with the red wines of Sicily, and particularly red wines that come from Mount Etna, a very active volcano, and the Cerisuolo di Vittoria area. And both of these areas, you know, Sicily for so many years was a ocean of bad, oxidized, uninteresting wines. And just really in the last 10 years, the wines have become fascinating and produced by dedicated vignerons, people who are growing grapes and making wines. And they're just so good and so interesting and complex but light. And they're fantastic wines.
We're on that page with you. We were in that region not so very long ago. We drank several. We enjoyed all of them. Okay, next one.
Well, this is a well-known name, but Beaujolais. For so long, the notion of Beaujolais was Beaujolais Nouveau, and it's taken a long time for good Beaujolais producers to sort of emerge from the economic and conceptual burden that placed on them. But there are so many good, dedicated Beaujolais producers who are making great wines now, and you can't think of Beaujolais now as a dirt cheap wine. It's a little bit more expensive, $20 a bottle of wines, but they are so good, and contrary to everybody's impression, they will age really well.
So
sometimes you can't help it because they're so good when they're young.
Now you're talking there about appellations like Morgon.
Yes, the so-called cru of Beaujolais. The 10 regions are considered the best terroirs there. But even from good producers, plain old Beaujolais is really good, and that is not an age-worthy wine. It's just great young.
Now, what
region?
Yeah, one last one, and we'll let you go.
And this is underappreciated, undervalued, and maybe requires a little bit of a leap of faith because these wines are not typical fruity sorts of sherry. Sherry is by far the most undervalued wine in the world. These are some of the most complex, unusual wines. I will specify in particular Fino and Manzanilla sherries perform the incredibly difficult feat of being slightly elevated in alcohol because they're fortified wines, maybe 15%, but they're at the same time delicate, light, filigreed, just incredibly it's a tightrope that they dance, and they're complex, and they're getting better because the sherry producers have realized that the dying market for mass-produced sweet sherries that they sold for a razor-thin margin has not coming back. So they're making and starting to make and sell really top-quality sherries, which has been there all the time, but they've just sort of blended it into this mediocre stuff.
And we had a whole meal with paired with that, right?
No, that was actually wines based on the Pedro Jimenez grape.
Ah,
those
can be dry, but most often we think of those as sweet.
We had them matched.
Yeah, we drank that through an entire meal right next to the vineyard in a designation called Montaña Moriles or something like that.
Yes.
You know it, I'm sure. Anyway,
absolutely.
Eric, we promised we would let you go. Thank you so much. It's been most enjoyable. We talked to you for at least as long without turning a hair. You must come back and talk to us again sometime soon.
I'd like that. It's been my great pleasure.
And thank
Eric,
you so much.
Good luck with your great book.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back with more about wine right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are, about to go to an appointment with a doctor, the wine doctor, who is Dwight Casimir, who has a prescription for what to do about wine in tough economic times.
DwightTheWineDoctor.com. Now, that's quite a handle. Dwight Casimir, am I close to pronouncing it correctly?
You've got it correct, absolutely.
He's joining us today, taking a break from organizing the spectacular food and wine event in New York City, which might cause some sounds stage off. So if that happens, please understand, listeners, that sometimes our guests have some really serious work to do as well as talking to us. But in thinking about the austere economy that we live in the United States and austerity programs around the world, Dwight, the wine doctor, came up with a very unusual program that really caught our attention and caused us to ask him to join us on the program today. Dwight, tell us about the austerity program.
Well, these are some lean financial times and certainly some uncertain financial times. But if you're a wine lover, it's a great opportunity to find a great bottle of wine for anywhere from $10, $15, $20 at the top. And these wines are comparable to any of the more expensive ones that we all thirst after from Napa, Sonoma, or from the premium regions of France. And they're coming from many of the austerity countries in Europe at bargain prices. Just look at some of the ones, and some of the names are familiar to us. Lamberto Frescobaldi, the Frescobaldi wines. They're sort of the leaders in all of this out of Tuscany.
Yeah. We had lunch with
Tiziana.
Tiziana
Frescobaldi.
Okay, sure.
And we've
got some, we're getting just a stream of great wines from them. Of course, they got their premium labels. They just had at Voce at the Time Warner Center a vertical tasting of their premium line, which is called Luce, which are Cabernet Merlot Bordeaux style blends that were really excellent. But they have a wine called Remole, which is a marriage of Sangiovese, the native Italian grape, and Cabernet, which is one we all know here in the United States. And it's an incredible, intense red, ruby red wine that goes great with all kinds of food, from casual pasta, hamburgers, ribs, all the way up to fine aged steaks. And you're going to love this. You can get it for $10 at most places. And it's an unbelievable wine that I would put up against any grape Chianti, any grape Burgundy. It's just delicious.
What was it that gave you the idea? Was it as you just described it to me that you saw an opportunity, or was there something else that caused the light to go on in your head and you said, what a great idea this would be?
Well, as you probably can imagine, I do a lot of traveling, and I was going through some of these areas that I went to Portugal back in the spring. I was in some of the off-the-beaten-path areas of Italy, down in Puglia, Umbria. I went through Piemonte, and some of the lesser-known DOCs in the Tuscan region, such as Morellino di Scandano, and also through Sagrantino. Some of the regions that really aren't on the map or aren't so well known here in this country. So the wines actually are just as good or even better than some of the wines that we know and love that are $40 and $50 a bottle, but because they don't have the imprimatur, the well-known name, or the varietal name is not as well known, but the wine is just as good and a fraction of the price. Portugal, where the majority of the wines you'll get from Portugal are in the $10 to $15 range, and they are some absolute beauties. I'm thinking of one, the Herdado de Esperal Montevideo White. Montevideo White sells for only $10 out of Portugal. Now this is a real hidden gem. I would liken it to a really beautiful Sauvignon Blanc for probably $20.
Dwight, a question.
Yes.
I understand that more obscure wines names attract lesser prices, but why would a very well-known vineyard such as Frescobaldi, with a top-end line, why would they produce cheaper wines that were just as good as the best? Or why wouldn't they produce all of their wines in a more affordable way and have them be great?
No, the connoisseur always knows the difference. But to the rest of us, maybe it's not so important that we have the absolute top oak or absolute fruit acid balance.
Okay, not so it's everyone relative.
Not everyone is going for the fine dining experience.
Okay,
some people just want a wine that they can drink every day and not even think about. And I have to admit that when I'm not dining out or entertaining guests or having a special meal, I drink wines that are of lesser or expensive wines. I want them to be good wines. I want them to taste good. I want them to be delicious. But they don't have to be the absolute fine aged.
Okay,
if I'm just having pasta or pizza at home.
It's not altogether accurate, then, what you said was that you would be able to put some of these wines up against the greatest wines out there, and it would still match up and be as good. So there is a difference between the more bargain-priced and the upper echelons, even if it's only a connoisseur's ability to know that.
Right. Yeah, these are not connoisseur-level wines, but they're certainly very good wines and very versatile wines.
I think that there's a point that I'd like to make here, and I'd like to see if you agree with me. Aside from Two Buck Chuck, which in Pennsylvania incidentally sells for about $5, one of the criticisms of American winemakers is that they are not making wines as well as they should in the popular price point that we just talked about. You can't find the same kind of middle ground of excellent American wines. You can Australian wines. You've always been able to do that, but somehow there's a gap.
Well, as you probably know, there's wine produced in just about every state of the Union. And if you go north of California, you go into Oregon, Willamette Valley, you go up into areas of Washington, Columbia Valley, and some of the lesser-known areas. There are some wines coming out of there that are quite delicious and quite affordable. Now, some of the more popular names out of Oregon and Washington, of course, they were bargains a few years ago, but those prices have gone up. But there are plenty more producers who are coming out with some wines in the reasonably priced range that are quite delicious, actually. So there are some other areas lesser-known. In the United States as well, but the bargains out of Europe, especially in the austerity countries, I don't think they can be beat right now.
Now, how do you find these, Dwight? I guess it's part of it's your secret, but give our listeners a little bit of your secret.
You know, it comes from just a lot of wine tasting and willing to be adventurous. Sometimes you'll pass up a thing on the shelf because you don't quite understand what's on the label, but there are some times if you do a little bit of research and look up the name on the internet, Google it, and read about the wine or collect information at wine tastings, you'll begin to see that there's some real bargains out there. And just like anything else, you have to dig to find the really good ones.
Now, you live in this wine community, I guess, right, in New York City?
Absolutely, yes.
So you have access, whereas our regular listeners across the globe, and especially across the United States, since that's the market I guess we're talking about, we don't have the same access as you do. So that's why someone like yourself is very helpful.
I've been surprised as I've traveled around the country and gone into local wine shops, and many times people don't even realize what they have. And I've gone in and looked at wines that I've seen in my travels and have been surprised to find them on the shelf in just a regular wine shop in a neighborhood, or even sometimes in places that have supermarket wine sections. I found some wines that I've encountered on my travels and have said, do you realize what you have here? They don't know. They don't, because they don't necessarily understand the language or what's on the label, that they have a real value there, a real find.
What was it that somebody spotted on all the good shelves in Paris shops, and it turns out that it was undervalued in the U.S. where it was produced? I think it was produced in, was it Portland or Maine?
You know, that happened once when I was in San Francisco. There was a grocery store that was, had somehow gotten their hands on a case of Bordeaux wine that sold for roughly $90 a bottle. They were selling it for like $15. And someone went in and bought it all. And
I'll bet.
when the word got out, of course, there was a huge run on his store.
Yeah.
I remember what it was now. What's the apple liqueur?
Oh, yeah.
Calvados.
Calvados.
And there's a distiller in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah,
who's making Calvados, and it's on the shelves of shops in Paris.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which suggests maybe that it's actually quite good.
Right.
I was going somewhere next, and I've forgotten where it was. Now I remember what it is. So you're constantly on the lookout for bargains, if you like, for unusual wines in an aggressive price point that don't make you feel guilty when you buy them and make you feel even less guilty when you drink them with your dinner. You've made a business out of this, I guess. Tell us about that.
These are the kinds of things I like to present to my readers. And when I suggest wine, I try to look at things that make wine accessible. I really want to make wine a part of the everyday dining experience, that wine is on the table just as other beverages are on the American table, and wine shouldn't be looked at any differently than another beverage, and a delightful one at that. So I think if you can have wines that are affordable, that taste good, that go with food, and make the dining experience more enjoyable, why not?
$10
wine from Portugal, a $15 wine from Spain, or $10 or $15 or $20 wine from Italy, I think makes life and the dining experience just a little bit better.
Now, what about wines from Greece?
Greece has got some very interesting wines. They're just starting to come back into the market with some wines that I think really fit the American palate and flavor profile. There was just the Star Chefs conference here in New York at Park Avenue Armory. And the Sommelier Association, which is based here at the French Culinary Institute, where the International Culinary Center, where I am right now, hosted a afternoon of tasting of Greek wines. There were 20 presented in all, and they went the flavor profile from dry white, which would be similar to Sauvignon Blanc, or to all the way up to sweet dessert wines from the Retsina grape that we're probably most familiar with in this country, but they're taking a different approach to it. The wines are not so bitter and acidic as they used to be. They're in a more elegant flavor profile, which is something I think that's going to attract many people to start drinking Greek wines again. And, of course, the prices, you can't beat $10 or $12 for some really, really lovely wines.
Now, do you give these names out on your blog? How does that work?
Yes, I do a wine a week, as well as stories on my travel. In fact, right now there are a whole series of articles on my recent trip through the Piemonte region. And I went to some of the regions that people aren't quite so familiar with out of the Piemonte. I went through the Montefalco. I went through the Roraro region, which is just now starting to bring some wines into the United States. And many of these were just really beautiful, expressive wines. And again, $10, $12, $15 a bottle, but really, really excellent, and a lot of care in the winemaking.
Now, how do people get information from you on a regular basis?
Through my blog and website, DwightTheWineDoctor.com, and DwightTheWineDoctor.blogspot. com, and you can communicate through those directly to me, and I'll be happy to send out information and let you know where I'm going to be in the country for tasting opportunities and meet and greet.
Great. So you do events around the country as well?
Absolutely. Well, yes, I travel to tastings. I'm going to be, in fact, I'll be back in Italy. I'll be at the Slow Food Conference in Turin later this month, October 26th through 29th. And then the following month, I'll be at the Vin Italy International Wine Competition. I'll be one of the judges for the International Wine Competition, in which there are some 3,000 entries.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is in Verona.
I said it's a zoo.
Oh, I know, yeah. It's a huge. In fact, we're going to be there for about a week. Judging and tasting wine. So it's going to be, there was a preliminary event that was held in Puglia in the spring that I was involved in which we rated over 200 wines a day. And it was really phenomenal. And we, from the growers and producers throughout the Puglia region, and some of those wines made the cut and are going to be presented at the International Wine Competition in November.
Yeah, a lot of these regions are coming up, and people are finally noticing it. I think we first went to Puglia how many years ago? 10?
12.
12 years ago. Yeah. And we had the wonderful experience of going to one of those roadside wine shops that serve like a gas station, and they have these tanks with hoses, and you fill up your jugs. It was
cheap. That trend is starting here in New York, and I think in a few other cities, where there are actually wine bars that serve wine from the glass in the same fashion as draft beer. You go to the microbrewery taverns, then they have the draft beer on tap. Uh-huh. Well, they're starting to now have wine on tap.
Yeah, I read about that. That's interesting.
That's another way. Of course, you don't have all the production of bottling and labeling and all that. That's another way to bring in wine at a very reasonable price point.
The place that Anne was talking about, you take your own 3-liter container
and fill it up,
and the total out of pocket cost is slightly less than $3.
That's amazing.
Terrible.
My local grocer here, speaking of the microbrews, they have a microbrew that they sell out of the store. And you bring your jug and fill it up, and, it's right by the salad bar in the prepared food section, so you can walk through and get your rotisserie chicken and then go fill up some ribs and then fill up your jug of microbrew and take it home and have a great little meal.
Yeah, some people do it with olive oil. Some shops have it with olive oil.
They don't drink it, though. They buy it, though. I think in the case of beer, they call them a growler.
That's what it is, yes. That's exactly what they call it, a growler.
I think in the case of wine, it's just a big bottle. It's just a really big bottle.
Well, we'll have to come up with a name for it.
Do you have a forecast of a couple of places that might be sort of just around the corner, not discovered yet, but you think they're going to be?
Yes. One name that pops into mind, wines of Croatia, and also wines from Lebanon. See them on the scene. Lebanon actually experienced some of their wines at the Vin Italy, the International Wine Fair in Verona last spring, and they had some lovely, lovely wines. So Lebanon at one time was, Beirut was known as the Paris of the Middle East, and of course after all the conflict there, things really went in a desperate state. But now the cities are coming back. There's some beautiful cafes, young chefs, young winemakers coming to the fore, and in fact, they're coming in from all over Europe and other parts of the continent, and they're bringing fresh ideas with them, and they're reviving the wine industry and the culinary industry. So there's some interesting finds coming out of there, and look for them in the next few months.
I was actually going to suggest that to you if you hadn't heard of it already, because about 2 years ago, we were at an excellent Lebanese restaurant in London. We had an excellent meal, and our host insisted that we have Lebanese wine, and we were just immensely surprised. We were chuckling under our breath until we took a taste of what were really quite excellent wines. So I was going to ask you if you'd heard of that, and of course you have, because that's your business, because you're Dwight
Wine Doctor. The thing is, the doctor knows. I know somebody who fixes furniture, and he's called the Furniture Doctor. It implies there's something you're going to be fixing.
Well, I try to prescribe wines that go with cuisine. So the marriage of wine and food is actually my priority.
Let's close with a thought for the day. I can't remember whether it's Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson. One of them said, wine is a constant reminder that God loves us. And the other one said, a day without wine is a day without sunshine. So go forth.
I think those are great quotes.
Go forth and multiply, Dwight the Wine Doctor. And we hope you have a great event in New York. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it was really delightful. And I look forward to speaking with you again and sharing the glass of wine.
Great. That sounds good, Dwight. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And welcome back. Next stop, a very favorite guest of ours. She always adds a little sass to the subject of wine. It's Natalie McLean talking about her book, Unquenchable.
And the title really says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah, A Tipsy Quest for the World's Best Bargain Wines.
Here's Natalie, and I promise I won't call her Nancy this time. Natalie McLean, welcome back to On the Menu, and thank you for communicating with us all the way from the 51st state.
Peter and Ann, it's great to be here.
And I wanted to start with a story that's a little bit that you're not expecting and that Ann's not expecting, because I lived in Australia for a number of years. Australians are known for loving their beer, probably even more than their wine. And a good friend of mine at the time said something very philosophical. He said, Peter, he said, there's no such thing as bad beer. It's just that some beer is better than others. Now, I'm guessing that Natalie McLean, among others, would say that does not apply to wine. And I think you have an observation about that at the beginning of your book when you answer the question, is it possible to get a wine worth drinking for $5 a bottle? And what was your answer?
Not unless all you want is a wet tongue, yes. Now, there is some really bad stuff out there.
Now, the funny part about it is that let's suppose you change the price to €5.
We're talking a possibility,
And you positioned yourself in many places in Europe, you would get an entirely satisfactory bottle of wine. In fact, even down as low as €3, you will still get wine with a bottle and a cork and a label on it and a vintage, something that might not be great wine for the cocktail hour, but good to go with food.
I mean, it's not just the exchange. We pay a lot when we're transporting wine from Europe, and then there's all the taxes that our dear governments impose on them. So, yeah, no, €3, you could probably find something great if you are in Europe drinking the local vino.
Well, what did we spend on that awful stuff we got out of the thing that looked like a gas pump?
That was like one. Well, it was lira in those days, but it was the equivalent of about €1.50, but the quantity you got was considerably larger. They had this like filling station for wine, where instead of filling up your car, you filled up your jug.
Well, that sounds really appetizing.
I didn't.
It was very popular. Isn't it?
I didn't think it was all that bad, but you have dedicated yourself, Natalie, to the pursuit of the bottle of good wine that's still affordable.
Yes.
And the world thanks you for this.
liver doesn't, but yeah, anyway.
You've written one book on the subject. You have a website, nataliemclean.com, which does this from day to day. And the reason we're talking today is we just got your second tome, Unquenchable, A Tipsy Quest for the World's Best Bargain Wines. And you are the author of Red Wine and Drunk All Over. I'm not sure what you're going to call your next book. I can hardly wait.
Yeah, me too. I don't know yet.
So the approach you took in this book was a little different than one might imagine that one would take, in that instead of just going back into your mental library of all the excellent, inexpensive wines you've drunk, you decided to do something geographical. Perhaps you can explain.
Absolutely. What I found from the first book, Red, White, and Drunk All Over, was that people really like the armchair travel aspect to it. So not all chapters, but some of them had journeys out to wine regions. So I thought, I think I would like each chapter in the second book to be a different region and travel-based, so that if you wanted to go there yourself, you'd have some insider tips. Or even if you never make it, you have a sense of what the place is like. And so the subtitle is all about bargain wine, so I wasn't going to go to Bordeaux and Burgundy. I'm sure some people might think they're bargains if you have a trust fund, but most of us don't. But there are many more regions that offer bargains than are in the book, but there's a limit to number of pages and so on. So I crowdsourced it with my website Scribers, as you mentioned, at nataliemclean.com, and asked them where did they think the best regions were, and more importantly, where were the colorful, iconic winemakers whom I could interview about their wines, who would really tell the story of that region and that wine, because I think that's what really makes it come to life.
Yeah, they're absolutely true. There are some fascinating stories. Quite a number of the people in the book we actually know. We've met ourselves, or we've heard of them. But I was interested in whether or not you could just quickly, for those people who are too mean to buy the book or too lazy, you picked eight regions altogether.
That's right.
Australia.
Argentina.
Well, Germany. I'm taking them in the order.
Oh, you are? Okay, yeah.
Germany. Then, for reasons which we've discussed before you came on the air, but which we won't reveal now, the Niagara region of Canada.
Yes.
The Cape Crusaders of South Africa, a part of Italy which used to be known for plonk, big red plonk, the island of Sicily, which we love so well, a smoldering liquid tango from Argentina, a storm of pleasure in every port. Portugal, of course. And then finally, you land up in Provence, because I guess you must be a great Peter Mayall fan, and one of these days you're going to write a book called A Year in Provence Making Wine, assuming they'll let you call it that. So,
we'll see.
So, Australia. Australia used to make plonk, started making excellent wines only within the last 30 years or so, as you note. But was there a particular thing that drew you there?
Well, I think Australia has been so successful in the North American market in terms of introducing its wines, and it's had several waves of success and some waning in between times. So there was the Australian invasion, I guess, in early 2000s, if you will. And then it fell out of favor as people didn't want big, oaky wines. But then I think now it's coming back again as they're focusing on regional differences and that sort of thing. But I think the Australians were the first to transform wine into liquid food, to make it accessible at a reasonable price. And so you have these big, juicy, fleshy Shiraz red wines and, of course, nice buttery Chardonnays, among others, of course, but they kind of led with those and were really good at it.
Did you try some of the Tasmanian wines?
I didn't get there on the trip, but I'm a big fan of Tasmanian Pinot Noirs because it's, as you know, a cool climate and it has wonderful, big cherry flavors that are nicely balanced with some acidity for food.
I think the Australian winemakers, I think, are also getting much more finesse about what they do. So they're working with difficult grapes like Pinot Noir, not only in Tasmania, but in the Mornington Peninsula. We ventured to Western Australia the last time we were there, and there's a whole book full of great wines just in that one part of the country.
Absolutely, and people think of Australia as all warm climate. I mean, technically warm climate for wine growing. And it's not. There are cool areas like Tasmania or, you know, the Mornington Peninsula, the Clare Valley. They produce marvelous, very nervy, edgy wines of Riesling and Pinot Noir, where you'd cool climate wines like Riesling and Pinot Noir that you would find in other regions as well.
Now, we were just at a big food meeting called the Chefs Collaborative in Seattle, Washington. Sitting at lunch one day, the gentleman sitting next to me was obviously Australian by accent, so we asked him where he was from, and he said Geelong. It turns out that Peter lived in Geelong for 4 years in the 1970s, but the most interesting aspect of that was that when Peter lived there, Geelong was known for sheep. There were no wineries anywhere.
Wow.
Now there are great wineries along the Bellarine Peninsula, as it's called, equally as important as the ones in the Mornington Peninsula, and it just shows you how quickly things can change.
Well, even if they had them, because if you remember, we kept the wine diary of everything we drank day by day, and when we got back to the States, you couldn't get any single one of them.
Oh, no, because the quantities being produced by these wineries then were very small. Now you have people who have capable of exporting in quite large quantity, even top wines like Grange, you can still get, because they're catering for a worldwide market as well as a local market. When we were dealing with it, people were just making for a domestic market that was pretty small, because nobody was interested in Australian-made wines unless they just couldn't afford anything else. Now you go to Germany next, and the Moselles and Rieslings of a country which, I guess, wines fell into disfavor. And,
yes.
And you explained very clearly why that was.
Well, I think we perhaps remember the days of Blue Nun and Black Tower and perhaps the vice grip of a sugar headache from those wines.
I remember it well.
It's hard to forget.
As the dripping candle in the bottles.
Exactly. Excellent for macrame as well. But that's one of the reasons Germany is a great value. So it's kind of one of those tips when you're looking for, okay, which regions do offer great values? Well, a region that is still trying to kick a bad reputation, even though it's undeserved today and goes back 10, 20 years ago, still they have that hangover image of those sweet syrupy wines, and they also have labels that are difficult for the most part to pronounce or read for Anglophones at least. And so you combine that, and German Rieslings and now even their Pinot Noirs are an amazingly great value on the shelf.
I was just going to give you three words to describe a latest interesting wine bargain, because we just got back from Berlin, German Pinot Noir.
Yes. Yeah, that's the up-and-coming wine from Germany. Not many people have tried them. They're not as prevalent as the Rieslings, but they're terrific.
The Chardonnay was really
good. Yeah, we also tried a Chardonnay with a German oyster, and that was extremely good. But it was a very lean Chardonnay, a lot like an unoaked Oregon Chardonnay,
right,
or an unoaked Australian Chardonnay for those who know those wines well. Now, let's go on. We mustn't hesitate here. We have to go on to another Pinot Noir-focused region, one that's known for its ice wine and other, unfortunate things to do with wine. But to the extent that they can keep the starlings off the grapes, Pinot Noir apparently grows very well in the Niagara region, which is something I didn't know.
It does. Niagara is a cool climate, and we're talking the Canadian Niagara region. Of course, you've got on the other side of the border, New York State has a vibrant and growing wine region itself. But in the book, I focus on Niagara. And again, I find Niagara and Riesling are kind of like red and white twins, and I don't mean that clonally or technically, but where you find great Pinot Noir, you'll also usually find great Riesling. And one thing that I explain in the book is that bargain doesn't just absolute rock bottom price. It's that price quality ratio, what you get for what you pay for. And so what I was looking at, because some of these Pinots from Niagara are $20-$30, some of them, the premium. But if you look at comparable quality from Burgundy, France, or elsewhere, even though I know there are stylistic differences, it's still quite a bargain.
Okay, well, let's cross the world again and go back south to South Africa, the Cape Crusaders. Here you're dealing with a wine culture that I guess suffered a great deal because they got kind of lazy because so much of the world wouldn't trade with South Africa for such a long time.
Exactly. So apartheid cut off their markets, their export markets, but also incoming technology, expertise, transfer of information. So again, you're looking at a region that suffered because of that and is now making big steps for recovery and offers tremendous value. Their flagship wine is Pinotage, which I'm hot and cold on depending on who's making it. My favorites and more dependable, I think, are Shiraz and Sauvignon Blanc.
Okay, so let's go to Anne's favorite part of the world, the island nation, she would call it, I guess, of Sicily, where her ancestors came from. And you focus in on a particular area, a fascinating area of wine growing, on the slopes of an active volcano.
Yes, Mount Etna. There's nothing like volcanic ash to make a nice finish in your wine. So Nero d'Avola is one of their grapes. They make luscious red wine. So if you like Shiraz or Malbec or whatever, you'll love Sicilian reds. They've come a long way, again, in their techniques. It's an old winemaking culture, but it was very rustic. It's modernized. And the insider tip here is, typically in traditional winemaking countries like Italy or France, the northern regions developed first and have the name. So Tuscany and Piedmont are very expensive in Italy. Go south to Sicily or even Sardinia. In France, it would be Bordeaux or Burgundy. Go south to Languedoc-Provence, and you're going to find more bargains.
Funnily enough, and I don't know if you've had the opportunity to explore this region, but we met a group of winemakers from the region of Calabria at a wine event in New York, and it was interesting to have one young man who's the present owner of the family vineyard, I guess, but it was founded by his grandfather, his great-grandfather, who made money in the wine business by growing grapes, making grape juice, and sending it to Piemonte to make the Barolos more powerful.
Exactly, and that was happening in France, too. They'd get from their southern neighbors, which, you know, had a lot more sun, more ripening, more robust but rustic wine. They'd get the big tankards coming up, the two trucks, at night, pulling up to the back and giving a little bit of extra fuel to those wines.
Now tangoing, I guess, goes with wine. Now, Miss Anne would love to learn how to tango, but we're probably a little late in life to do that. But
never too late.
Curiously enough, we met a gang of winemakers in Paso Robles, California, used to hire somebody to teach them to dance tango on Tuesday nights.
Oh.
Now, it is not written how much Pinot Noir they drank at the same time as they were doing that. Probably some. But that's a backwards way of getting us to the country of the famous Argentine tango and what you call a smoldering liquid.
Yes, I couldn't avoid that word, smoldering. It goes with tango, and it goes with their famous Malbec red wines. Very luscious. I think somewhere between a Shiraz and a Cabernet or a Merlot. So it's got all the juicy, fleshy black fruit. I think a bit more structure and finesse than, say, an Aussie Shiraz.
One of the most interesting things I think about that is the whole concept that Malbec didn't originate in Argentina. It actually originated in a part of France, southwestern France, I think, and they almost stopped growing it, and now they started growing it again.
Exactly. So Argentina has made it a flagship standalone red wine. In France, including Bordeaux, it was always part of a blend, and it was there to add color and robust body weight to it. But the Argentines do it very differently because they are just focusing on a single grape, and it has a lot of roundness, a lot of finesse. Again, they've come a long way in their technique.
And a storm of pleasure in every port. Portugal, known for sweet wines, mostly for the market for sweet wines in my native land, and the reason that I understand that Portugal is known as Britain's oldest ally, but here you found conventional wine grapes growing in the same region, famous for its port.
Yes, so port, I think, is one of the most undervalued wines in the world. It is a dessert-fortified sweet wine, but I think that people look at it and think, oh, that's going to be alcohol levels like whiskey, which is not true. It's only about 20%. When you're looking at spirits, it's double that or more. People also get a little off-put by sweet, but this, when sweet is balanced with all kinds of other complexities or acidity or whatever, it comes off as a very satisfying after-dinner drink. Also, though, as you mentioned, they're growing red grapes and making dry, red, robust table wines from grapes that are very obscure, traditionally used for port, and are producing some surprisingly very modern styles of red wines.
And interestingly enough, wines that sell in the Pennsylvania State Liquor Store, which we're stuck with here in Pennsylvania, at a price point of $8 or $9 a bottle,
right?
Which is not quite your magic $5 a bottle, but it's sure a hell of a lot better than that in taste.
Exactly.
And then you couldn't resist, I guess. You just had to go back to France.
Yes.
And the wonderful, the region which provides the world with rosé, a much maligned wine,
mm-hmm.
I think you will agree.
Yes.
And I think we only have one tip that I picked up somewhere along the way, and you can confirm whether this is really true. Often a sommelier or a wine waiter will try to impress you by suggesting to you that this wine that is 2005 is going to be better than this wine which is 2010 vintage because it's spent more time in the barrel, more time in the bottle. And I understand in the case of rosé that's absolutely the opposite is true, and that you should be drinking last year's if not this year's.
Precisely, yeah. You want to. Rosé is meant to be fresh, quaffable, and of the moment kind of pleasure. But it is, again, this is one of those tips. It's a maligned grape or style of wine, just as Germany was a maligned country. So you're getting great value. And from Provence, whenever you go to Provence or even the Rhone Valley of France right above it, especially Tavel, you're always getting a dry style. They don't make sweet. So if you're uncertain and you don't want a sweeter rosé, you want a bone-dry, refreshing aperitif or something to go with food, you're guaranteed to get that if you go with Provence.
And listeners, a final thought for you, because we've taken an awful lot of Natalie's time. If you want more of the same conversation, if you want more of the same information, www.nataliemclean.com. Her blog and all the other resources on her website are available to you. I'm sure she answers email as well. And
yep.
We thank you so much for joining us today. It was fun to tour the world with you in search of affordable wines, and we thank you so much for your insight and conversation.
Well, thank you, Peter and Anne. You have a great weekend. Enjoy some good wine tonight, I hope.
Yeah,
yes,
I hope
indeed.
So.
Thank you.
Okay,
thanks,
take care.
Then.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it. I hope you learned a lot in this week's program all about wines, and that you'll put it to use in your on your next purchase, and that you'll enjoy your further exploration of wine even more because of these really wonderful guests in today's program. And we'll be here, same time, same place next week. We hope you will be too.
Bye-bye.